Tim Keller is going to come speak to us on reasons for God, a belief in an age of skepticism. Please welcome him.
Yes, what is the reason for God, or what is the reasoning that leads to belief in God? It's a silly fool's errand to try to cover that in a talk. I can guarantee tonight what I say is going to be too sketchy. I will always treat all issues inadequately tonight. I just want to get that straight from the beginning. When I was your age, I never listened to the end of a sentence that began, "When I was your age." But the end of this sentence goes like this. When I was your age, I was told that eventually, because we were becoming a more economically, technologically, scientifically advanced country and society, that as human society matured, people got less religious. And eventually, thick, robust, orthodox, crunchy belief in God and the supernatural, that would go away. And it hasn't happened. I recently had a chance to speak at Google, and their main campus in Silicon Valley. And they have a series called Authors at Google. And so they have this author series that's right in the center of their workplace. And lots of people come. But everybody was rather surprised, because my subject is why you should believe in God. And here, right in the middle of Google, this is a very secular, very cutting edge, you know, organization. And we had the biggest turnout they ever had for an author, even though nobody had ever heard of me. They didn't come because they knew me. It was the subject. In fact, they actually, two people pointed something out. There's in this series, by far, they said, you're the biggest, this topic was the biggest draw. And the second biggest draw was another author named Violet Blue, who's an internet porn star. And you and Violet Blue are the two biggest draws. Everybody who believes or disbelieves in God believes or disbelieves for three sets of reasons. Always three sets of reasons. We're not just talking about people who believe, but also people who decide, I don't believe. And those three sets of reasons I'll call intellectual, personal, and social. First is the intellectual reasons. One of the reasons you believe or don't believe in God or religion, and occasionally I'm a Christian minister, so I always use Christianity as the example of a religion. One of the reasons why you believe or don't believe is that you've thought about the objections to faith, you've listened to the arguments for faith, and you've either found the arguments compelling or not. You found the problems and the objections insurmountable or not. So one of the reasons why you believe or disbelieve are what we call reasons proper. Intellectual reasons, rationality, thinking. But secondly, nobody believes or disbelieves just for reasons, rational, you know, reasons proper. People also believe or disbelieve because of personal experience, interpreted personal experience. So, for example, some people have horrible tragedies in their lives. Or let's put it this way. Two people have horrible tragedies in their lives, equally horrible, equally tragic. And one says, this means I need God. I'm never going to be able to make it in life. I need God. And the other person, having the very same experience, says, this means I don't need a God who lets stuff like this happen. How people interpret personal experience is a huge part of why they believe or don't believe. Enormous. I mean, just to give you a quick example of that, is I've seen this happen. You go to seminary. I went to seminary. And in the seminary, years ago, they would go through all the apparent or proposed contradictions in the Bible. And we'd sit there and we'd look at them and we'd see all the possibilities and we'd see how some of them really resolve if you think more about them, and you see some of them don't seem to resolve, but here's some possible experiences, and you pop out on the other side, and it was always we'd have the same teacher, we would have the same, you know, the same arguments, and there would always be somebody on the other side whose faith was really shaken, other people whose faith was really strengthened, and almost always it wasn't just reasoning; it had a lot to do with what else was going on in their lives. And I'll be careful here. I'll give you a cautionary in a moment. So there's intellectual, there's personal, and finally there's the social. There's a whole area of a discipline that's developed in the last generation called the sociology of knowledge, which is a very discomforting discipline, because what it tells us is that to a great degree, what we believe is socially conditioned. Or, put it in the most crass way, the people who you need the most and the people you're the most dependent upon and the people you most admire, in other words, your community, the people that you most want to accept you, the people who are in the community you most want to be part of. For some strange reason, their beliefs seem incredibly plausible. And people who are in communities you want nothing to do with, or that you don't admire, or you don't need, their beliefs don't seem very plausible at all. And I think most of us have to recognize that if you lost your faith in God, having been raised in faith, you lost your faith in God to a great degree, it's because you hung out with a lot of other people who were making, you know, they were just making jokes and being very cynical about religious faith, and you certainly didn't want to look too stupid. But it also works the other way around. There's absolutely no doubt about that. You know, people very often have fall in with a group of believers who they really respect and they just think are so wonderful and smart, and next thing you know, everything they say sounds plausible. Now, let's be careful. You must never, and we all do, you must never think that belief or disbelief reduces to one of those. It's always three, always three. And, you know, here's what you do wrong. There's always a tendency to say, I came to my beliefs through reasoning, and you over there came to your beliefs through social conditioning or personal trauma or something like that. In other words, very often Christians say to non-Christians, they say, well, you know, your problem is you just, had that horrible relationship with your father, and so now you can't handle God, and you're just closing your eyes to the facts because you're traumatized, and vice versa. I mean, often I've had people like this say to me, I'm a secular person, and I really don't believe in God, or at least I believe all religions are equally true or untrue. You know, I'm a secular relativist. And let me show you, you Christian minister, you think you've got the truth. If you were born in Madagascar, you wouldn't even be a Christian. So how dare you talk about how you're right. If you're in Madagascar, if you were just accidentally born in another place, Madagascar, you wouldn't even be a Christian. Okay, so I would sit back and say, now what? What's the point here? And here's what the point is. The point is, I've come to my secular relativism by thinking, and you are a product of social conditioning. And you know what you say? The right comeback to somebody who says, I'm a secular relativist, and you're only a Christian. If you were born in Madagascar, you wouldn't be a Christian. You say it, but if you were born in Madagascar, you wouldn't be a secular relativist. And so are you trying to say that your secular relativism, because you're here at University of Pennsylvania and you want to be accepted and you've been socially conditioned? I mean, what? Let's not do that. Let's not do that. If you can reduce somebody's belief to social conditioning, I mean, Peter Berger, who's one of the fathers of the sociology of knowledge, has a fascinating a book called Rumor of Angels. He's got a chapter called Relativizing the Relativizers, and in there he points something out. He says the belief that all assertions are just socially conditioned, that we didn't really come to them because of thinking, we have to believe in them because of our community, to say all assertions are socially conditioned would have to be socially conditioned and therefore not true. It's a combination of things. There's social conditioning and there's reasoning and there's personal, and we still have to decide which of these competing truth claims, which of these competing assertions are right or the best. So don't just reduce people and say, oh, you believe what you believe because of this or that. It's all three. It always is all three. Your belief, your disbelief is all three. And it's important to see, just in order not only for you to realize your belief or disbelief perhaps is unbalanced. You know, when I say it's all three, it doesn't mean you might not be unbalanced. And you might be overly socially conditioned, having not thought it through. Or you could become a Christian through a personal tragedy and not having really thought it out, just needing and wanting to believe in God and finding some Christians who will support you. Next thing you know, you're baptized. And you actually, the rational side is too weak. I mean, you can get unbalanced here, but you must never turn around to other people and say, I'm all this and you're all that. Don't do that. The reasons for God are complicated. What are the reasons for God? And I want to suggest to you there's three, I'd like to organize them into three rungs on a ladder. Not that everybody moves through them sequentially, but three rungs on a ladder. The first rung is you are moving toward God, because we're now drilling down into the intellectual reasons, okay? You're moving toward God when you begin to realize that it takes as much faith to disbelieve in God as to believe. And the reason is because all the arguments that try to disprove God, all the arguments that try to prove the non-existence of God, all the arguments that try to say there can't be a God, or there can't be the God of the Bible, or there can't be a Christianity, can't be true, all those arguments fall flat. They fail. The first one is evil and suffering. And in many ways, this is the strongest, I would say, because it's a combination of philosophical and personal. And the argument goes like this. Look at all the senseless, pointless evil and suffering in the world. Now, given pointless evil and suffering, there might be a good God who's not powerful enough to stop it. Or there might be a powerful God who's not good enough to want to stop it. But if there was a good and all-powerful God, there couldn't be pointless, senseless evil and suffering. He would not want it there, and he would be able to stop it. But since there is pointless evil and suffering, therefore there can't be the all-powerful, all-good God of the Bible. That's the argument. Now, because people have had a lot of personal tragedies, the philosophical argument at the street level, which I just gave you, it has a certain amount of traction, but philosophically it doesn't work. In fact, a leading philosopher, William Alston, who was at Syracuse for many years, not too long ago wrote this. He says, "The effort to demonstrate that evil disproves God is now acknowledged on almost all sides in philosophy as completely bankrupt." That's an amazing statement. And he points out there hasn't been a top-level, full-blown effort written by a philosopher to show how evil and suffering disproves God since maybe J.L. Mackey's book, Miracle of Theism, in 1982. Why? Here's the Achilles heel in the argument. You say, look at all this pointless evil and suffering. That's the premise. Look at all this pointless, senseless evil and suffering. Wait a minute. Let's stop. How do you know it's pointless and senseless? How do you know God doesn't have a good reason for allowing evil and suffering to go on? What's your response? Your response is, well, I can't think of any good reason. I've thought about it for years. Nobody has any good reason. No. Wait a minute. You know what you just said? You just said, you're saying, because I can't think of any good possible reason for God to allow evil and suffering to continue, there can't be a good reason. And that isn't true. See, if you have a God big enough and powerful enough to be mad at that he hasn't stopped evil and suffering, then at the same time you've got a God big enough and powerful enough to have reasons for allowing it to continue that you can't think of. You can't have it both ways. If he's big enough to be mad at, he's big enough to say, well, maybe I don't know it. And the whole argument falls apart, actually. And that's the reason why William Alston says across the board, people are not going there anymore. Here's a second argument. I call it the Christopher Hitchens argument against the existence of God. And he, in his book, God is Not Great, does a really vivid job of this. He basically says, the traditional God of religion can exist because if the traditional God of religion did exist, his believers wouldn't be so uniformly evil. And he goes through and he shows all kinds of places in the world. You know that one place where he has all the bees? It's, I forget where they all are. You know, it's like six cities. Beirut is one of them. I remember where the other ones were. But anyway, he goes through and he shows all of the he shows the violence, he shows the injustice, he shows the genocide, he shows the horrible stuff that's been done in the name of God. And he says, how in the world could a real God exist if believers in him do that sort of thing? So religion poisons everything. Let's just drop the idea of God. Well, here's the problem. Here's a big problem with the argument. There's something about the human heart that not only can be evil and be violent in any worldview, in any culture, but there's something about the human heart that is so prone to exploitation and violence that it can use any set of beliefs or disbelief in God as a warrant for violence. You can grow violence in absolutely any worldview soil. So, for example, Buddhism, we think of that as a pretty peaceful thing. Buddhism and Shinto produced Japanese militarism of World War II. Christianity and beliefs of Christianity has produced everything from the 11th and 12th century crusades down to people shooting abortion doctors. Islam is the inspiration for a global terrorist movement. But then, now look, then what about atheism? Well, here's Stalin. Here's the Khmer Rouge. Here's the Killing Fields. Now, somebody would come back to me on this whenever I say this, and they say, oh, it wasn't atheism that led to that. It was fanatical communism. Atheism isn't going to lead to that kind of violence, except there's a Polish poet, a Nobel Prize winner, I think, Miłosz, who wrote a Seshalal Miyosh, who wrote a little essay called The Discreet Charms of Nihilism. I wish I'd thought of that title myself. The Discreet Charms of Nihilism. And of course, he's Polish. He's come up in, he's seen the communist atheist regime. He saw what happened there. He says, I've seen atheism used as a warrant, as an impetus for violence. You know why? Because an atheist knows, and he says, I've seen this, an atheist knows that if I can get away with something incredibly cruel and violent and evil in this life, I've really gotten away with it. If I can get away with it in this life, I get away with it. There's no reckoning. There's no afterlife. And see, what Miyosh says is, it's not just that that people are evil in spite of Christianity, or people are evil in spite of atheism. The fact of the matter is, people can be evil because of the beliefs. You can take any set of beliefs and twist them into violence. And historically, the simple fact is, every set of beliefs, every kind of belief of God and disbelief of God and kind of religion has produced it. You know what this means? It's a tie. It's a wash. You can't do that. I'm not going to. It would be absolutely wrong for somebody to say, oh, look at the violence that atheism has produced. Atheism produces violence. Well, that's, you know, it doesn't necessarily. It just means that violence can use atheism. It's not the same thing as atheism produces violence. But then I don't want somebody to turn around, look at Christianity, look at Islam. It produces violence. Well, I'm not going to do it to you, so you don't do it to me. Because it's a wash. It's a tie. And therefore, it means that the argument fails. It doesn't disprove there's a God. There's one last one, and this is actually in some ways the most powerful of all the arguments that says nobody can know there's a God or there can't be a God, and that is this argument. That is, I've had people listen to me talk like this, obviously not monologue for 30 minutes, but you know, when I'm talking to people, I go through some of these things, and they say, wait a minute, what are you talking about? I can't disprove God. I don't have to disprove the existence of God. You got to prove him. And as long as you don't prove him, unless you give me a slam dunk argument, you know, I don't have to believe in the abominable snowman unless you prove him. I don't have to believe that there's an island in the Pacific at this location unless you can prove it. And so I don't have to believe in God unless you can prove it. And if you can't prove it, then God doesn't exist. And until you prove it, he doesn't exist. Simple. No, it's not. There's a huge leap of faith in there. Do you know what that is? You know, you're not being objective. You're not being rational at all. There's a huge leap of faith. And here's the leap of faith. If there is a God who created us, he would, by definition, have to be something bigger than the universe, or you might say outside the universe. And there's no doubt that anything inside the universe, there's no reason to believe in it, unless we can prove it, you know. But is God like an island in the Pacific? Is God like an abominable snowman? If he's the creator, he couldn't be. He couldn't fit inside the universe, and therefore, to say he's got to be proven, maybe you're right, maybe you're wrong, but guess what? It's a huge leap of faith, and you're assuming something about the nature of God that you say you don't believe in. You sit there and say, well, until you prove God to me, I don't have to believe in him. Okay, prove me something else. If any of you have taken even the first philosophy class, you know that you and I can't prove to you that I'm not a butterfly dreaming I'm a man. And by the way, you can't prove that your memory works. There is no non-circular argument that can prove that your memory works, because the world might be only 5 minutes old and your memory is malfunctioning. Well, how are you going to prove that otherwise? You can't even begin to talk about your memory without using it, which is begging the question. You have absolutely, there's no way you can prove that what I'm actually seeing out there is really there. And anybody who's ever seen The Matrix knows it. You're basing your life on all kinds of stuff you can't prove, all kinds of stuff. You can hardly prove anything, and you're basing your life on it. How's God going to feel if he's there? That you're basing your life on all kinds of stuff you can't prove. But God, if he's, you know, you got to prove him or else I'm not going to look for him. Now here's where we are. It's only rung one, but I'll tell you, it's important. And I've given rung one more treatment I can give rung two tonight. But here's what you have. If you can't disprove God, if you can't prove the non-existence of God, and you can't, then if you're living as if there is no God tonight, that is a huge risk. And it's an act of faith, and you're taking your life in your hands, spiritually speaking. It's a spiritual commitment as big as a believer giving his or her life to God. See, just to live as if there is no God, since you can't disprove him, that God is there, is a spiritual commitment. Do you see that? And therefore it's a big act of faith. It's a huge one. If you haven't thought about it, well, think about it. And if it starts to say, make you say, well, you're on the first rung. Rung two works like this. It's a bigger leap of faith. It's a bigger leap in the dark to disbelieve in God than to believe. In other words, when you come to see that, that's a higher rung. When you come to realize that belief in God makes far more sense of what we actually see and know in this world, that when you look at the things we see and know, belief in God makes sense of them. Non-existence of God doesn't make any sense of them. You can still believe in the non-existence of God and still hold to these things, and yet it's a much bigger leap of faith, a much bigger leap in the dark than if you believed in God. And when that begins to dawn on you, you start to say, well, you know, what is my problem with belief in God? The first thing is actually kind of more popular in the last few years than it was when I was younger. But one of the things that many physicists talk about, both Christians and non-Christians, is the fine-tuning of the universe. And by the fine-tuning of the universe, some people call it the anthropic principle. It means the fundamental regularities of and constants of physics, like the speed of light, gravitational constant, strength of the weak and strong nuclear forces. It's almost like there's 1,000 dials, and every one of them has to be exactly where they are, and every one of them has to be tuned to all the others for there to be any possibility of organic life and therefore human life. So the world is almost exactly what, in fact, it's the only possible world in which we could grow. So it looks like it's been prepared for us. It looks like God prepared it for us. And people say, oh, it's a 1 in a trillion chance that all of those all those constants would be exactly what we need in order to grow human life, and therefore that shows that there's God. That's evidence for God. Well, the comeback, and by the way, people like Richard Dawkins must feel the strength of this argument, because every one of the New Atheist books deals with it, I think. And what Dawkins comes back, which is the standard one, and it's true, it works. He says, at the Big Bang, there could have been millions, trillions, trillions of trillions of universes all created at the same time. And sure, one of them is going to have human life. And therefore, we just happen to be in the one that does. I mean, obviously, we have to be in the one that does, and therefore, it doesn't prove God. Sure, it's a long shot, but it doesn't prove God. And he's right. But Alvin Plantinga, a Christian philosopher at Notre Dame, says, well, let's do a thought experiment. Imagine you're playing a game of poker, and the man who's dealing has just dealt himself 20 straight hands of four aces. Okay. And when he deals himself the 20th hand of four aces, you throw your cards down, you get up, and even though you're like, you're only a, you know, you're a 4'10" woman, size 2, you're still ready to, you're just going to punch him. And he says, wait. He says, I know it looks suspicious. He says, but what if there is an infinite succession of universes so that for any possible distribution of possible poker hands, there's one universe in which this possibility is realized? We just happen to find ourselves in the one where I always deal myself four aces without cheating. Why couldn't that be the case? You can't prove that I'm cheating. And guess what? Philosophically, that's right. You can't prove it. If there's trillions of universes, there almost has to be one in which all that's true. But as Plantinga points out, guess what? What are you going to do? You're going to punch him anyway. You're all going to punch him. Why? Because you don't... Why? Because it would be perfectly warranted to conclude that he's cheating. Nobody lives their lives on the possibility that this is a 1 in a trillion chance that it just happened. You assume somebody did it. Nobody lives like that. Nobody lives like that. And yet, when you say, well, the fine-tuning of the universe doesn't prove God. No, it doesn't prove God. It could have happened. Yeah, it could have happened that way. But you don't live like that in any other area. You would never act like that in any other area. So what's your big problem with God? There must be a pretty big problem with God. I'll give you one more. Human rights. Alan Dershowitz, in his book, Shouting Fire, talks about the huge problem human rights is if you don't believe in God. A human right is the conviction, you might say, that human beings are of infinite worth, and therefore, no matter whether you're rich or poor, no matter your racial identity, no matter whether you're male or female, every individual human being has rights and must not be exploited, must not be trampled upon. He says, well, why should we believe in human rights? It's not self-evident to everybody. You can't prove it in a test tube. So why do we believe in human rights? Why would they be there? Why would they be true? He says the first possibility is God. God made us in his image, and therefore we are his children, and therefore we're valuable. But he says too many of us don't believe in God. We need to find another basis for human rights. The second possibility, he says, is nature. He says maybe it's the law of nature. Maybe if we look out at nature, we'll see it's just natural to honor the individual and to care for people and to love people. And he says no. See, if there is no God and you look at nature, every single person in this room got here through the strong eating the weak. Every single person in this room got here through stronger organisms trampling weaker organisms. That's why you're here. And now we're going to turn around and say, that's wrong. If it's wrong, it's not wrong. If it's wrong, nature's wrong. You realize that. So you can't look to nature to get this. Annie Dillard won the Pulitzer Prize for Pilgrim at Tinker Creek. She wrote this book in which she moved out into the rural Virginia and lived by a creek. And she wanted to get close to nature. She thought it would ennoble her. And when she actually saw how the animals and insects worked, you know, in the strong eating the weak, it just brutalized her. And at one point she says this. She says, evolution loves death more than it loves you or me or anyone. I had thought to live by the side of the creek in order to shape my life to its free flow, but I seem to have reached a point where I must draw the line. I must part ways with the only world I know. Look, the robin may die, she saw a robin die, the most gruesome of slow deaths, and nature is not displeased. The sun comes up, the creek rolls on, the survivors still sing, but I cannot feel that way about your death, nor you about mine, nor either of us about the robins. We value the individual supremely, and nature values us not a whit. It looks as though I may have to reject this creek life unless I want to be utterly brutalized and dehumanized. Consider the, and then she says, either this world, nature, is a monster or I'm a freak. Let's consider both. Consider the former, the world is a monster. There's not a people in the world that behaves as badly as praying mantises. But wait, you say, there's no right or wrong in nature. Right and wrong is a human concept. Precisely. We are moral creatures in a universe that is running on chance and death, careening blindly from nowhere to nowhere, which somehow produced wonderful us. This world runs on chance and death and power. But I cherish life and the rights of the weak versus the strong. But the world does not. So I crawled by chance through... I crawled by chance through survival of the fittest out of a sea of amino acids and evolved, and now I whirl around and shake my fist at that sea and I cry, shame on you. We little blobs of soft tissue crawling around on the one planet's skin are right and the whole universe is wrong. The world is a monster. That didn't work. Okay, let's consider the alternative. Nature is fine. Our feelings are freakishly amiss. The frog that the giant water bug sucked had a rush of feeling for about a second before its brain turned to broth. She saw a water bug sting a toad or a frog and then put its stinger down into his brain and just suck its brains out until it just collapsed. She says, I have been sapped by various strong feelings about that incident for years, and yet nature considers it perfectly normal. All right, then. It's our emotions and values that are amiss. We are freaks. The world is fine. So let us all go have lobotomies to restore us to our natural state. We can leave the library, then go back to the creek lobotomized and live on its banks as untroubled as any muskrat or reed. You first. So, guess what? Where, if nature is all there is, if this material world is all there is, why would we feel that it's wrong? How dare we? Where do we get a standard to say that nature is unnatural? What's natural then? If nature is unnatural, what the heck is natural? And the only way you get that would be to say, I have a supra, outside of natural, I have a supernatural standard. Whoops, we're close to God. Let's keep going then. So we can't get it from nature. Here's the third thing, positive law. And the third thing Dershowitz says is maybe we have human rights because we just create them. We think that the society goes better with human rights. So our legislative majorities create human rights. He says, that will never work. And he says, I'll tell you why. I can tell you at the micro and the macro level. At the macro level, you know what this means? It means genocide is only wrong because we say so. It's only wrong because a majority said so. And what it also means is the majority, what about if 60% say, no, genocide isn't wrong, we take that rights away, we're going to destroy the 40%. On what basis do you say stop? You see, if you create human rights, then you can decreate human rights. And he says, you know, as a lawyer, all I know is the whole purpose of human rights is to be able to turn to the majority, to the big person, and to say, you have to honor the rights of my client. So he says, unless human rights are there, unless they're discovered, not created, they're no use. And besides that, we do think that they're there. We don't think we create them. We don't believe that genocide is wrong because we say it is. We believe genocide is wrong. But why would it be wrong when that's how nature works? You know what he says? He says the fourth possibility, if we're not getting it from God, we're not getting it from nature, we're not getting it from creating, they're just there. We really don't know why they're there. They're just there. It doesn't prove God. Of course, to say that they're there and we don't know why they're there, we don't know why they should be there, but they're just there. But you see, here's where we are, and I got to close up here. Of course, do you believe in human rights and disbelieve in God? You certainly can do that. You just realize what an enormous leap it is. See, the premise that there is no God should lead to the conclusion that there's no such thing as human rights except created ones. But if your premise leads you to a conclusion that you know isn't true, why not change the premise? You see, if belief in God makes sense of the fine-tuning, belief in God makes sense of human rights, and I could give you 20 more things, but time is rushing on. What's your problem with belief in God then? What is this big difficulty you've got? What's going on? And that brings me to the third and last point, and it's a brief one, fortunately for you. Where does reasoning God for God take us? Here's where it takes us. The last rung on the ladder, you might say, is when you come to realize that reasoning, you can reason to probability, but it takes personal commitment to get to certainty. You can reason to probability, but it takes personal commitment to get to certainty. Because somebody might say, well, now you haven't shown me that God's real. You seem to be just saying he's likely to be there. Oh, I can do better than that. But keep this in mind. If one of you says, if I was the leader of a company, and I said, I need to hire somebody, and a bunch of people come and they apply for the job, using my reason, I can get to the place where this person is probably the right one. Using my reason and my, and I do my due diligence and I do the references and I do the tests and I think and I interview, and I can, with my mind, I can get to the place where this person is probably the right one. The only way I'm going to be able to really be sure this person's the right one is I got to bite. I got to commit. I got to risk. I got to personally commit, and I have to have the person actually on my staff, and in a year, I say, oh, this is the perfect person. Or put it this way. Let's just imagine I'm falling off a cliff. And I'm about to plunge down, I'm going to die. But at the last minute, I look over to my right, and I see a branch sticking out of the cliff. And let's say that branch actually does have enough strength in it to hold me up if I grab it and save me. If I look at that branch and I say, oh, I really don't know that, I don't think it's going to work, but I grab it, I'm saved. Very little faith, but I'm saved. On the other hand, if I look at the branch and say, I know that branch can save, I've seen other people grab that branch and I don't reach out for it, I'm dead. Because, listen, see, it's not the strength of your faith, but the object of your faith that saves you. And what that means, therefore, is weak faith and a strong object is enormously superior to strong faith and a weak object. And see, strong faith and a weak object is fatally inferior the weak faith and a strong object. What you have to do is you have to commit. And then you get to certainty. You know, you can get to certainty, but not only with one bucket. Not only with a rational bucket. And here's where Christianity, you say, oh, yeah, here's where Christianity has a leg up. And I'm really talking very generally. I've really been trying to lay a groundwork, and I haven't said, why be a Christian? But I can tell you this. Christianity has a leg up on all other religions. May I say that? I'm a minister. Don't I have the, you know? And here's why. If personal commitment is the key to certainty, Dorothy Sayers was one of the first women who ever graduated from Oxford, and she was a writer of mystery stories. And one of the mystery stories, she wrote a series of stories and novels about Peter Wimsey, who was an aristocratic detective, and he solves the cases. Halfway through the series, a woman figure shows up. And this woman figure is one of the first women who ever graduated from Oxford. And she's a writer of detective novels. And she falls in love with Peter, and they get married. And most people that know anything about the series and anything about Dorothy Sayers know what happened. Remember how we said, what Lewis said, is the only way Hamlet's going to know anything about Shakespeare is if Shakespeare writes something about himself into the play? Dorothy Sayers looked into the world that she had created, and she saw her main character, and she fell in love with him. And she saw that he was lonely. And so what happens is she comes on in, and through, as some of you know, a rather tempestuous kind of love-hate relationship for a while. In the end, they get married and live happily ever after. And basically, she looked into the world. She saw Peter. She wanted to love him. She wanted to rescue him. She wanted to save him. And so she put herself in, and she did. And we look at that, and we go, oh. Except the gospel is that God created this world. He looks into this world, and he sees us flailing around, sinking, and he loved us. He loved us. And he wrote himself in. He just didn't give us information. He wrote himself into our world in the form of Jesus Christ, who lived the life we should have lived, died the death we should have died, on the cross for our sins, was raised on the third day. That's a whole other lecture, but look, you want a watertight argument? God's given you something better than a watertight argument. He's given you a watertight person against whom there can be no argument. You look at him, and you see him. And you see, in fact, the Bible even calls him, guess what, the branch. And you can grab hold of him. And that takes you from probability to certainty. And in many ways, it's, of all the faiths, it's the only one that says God came down and became a human being and wrote himself into the play, not just information, not just facts about here's how I want you to live. You know, every other founder of a religion said, I'm a prophet telling you how to find God, but only Jesus Christ came and said, I'm God, come to find you.